If you're curious to engage with a lot of the topics we explore on the podcast in more creative and embodied ways, we welcome you to join us in Alchemize, our 10-week audio-based program of daily imagination practices intended to disrupt status quo ways of thinking, sensing, relating, and being. To be honest, without any grant support for our show right now, and we did just get turned down by several mainstream environmentalism philanthropies, this program and our Patreon are our primary means of supporting our labor for these free podcasts right now. We really want to remain untethered to corporate interests, and every small contribution to our Patreon or enrollment in our program Alchemize helps to ensure that we can continue producing these vital conversations that feature voices and perspectives often sidelined from mainstream media. So if you value our work and want to dive deeper with us, join us in Alchemize today at greendreamer.com/alchemize and join our Patreon starting at just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Thank you so, so much for however you are able to support our work during these critical times. We are so deeply grateful. Hey, it's your host, Kamea Shane, and you're listening to Green Dreamer, which explores our paths to collective healing, ecological regeneration, and true abundance and wellness for all. As a community-powered show made possible by listeners like you, we are calling in your direct support starting at a gift of $2, which really adds up for us, to help us sustain and keep the show going. So if you value these conversations, you can join our community at greendreamer.com/support. And also, we just recently relaunched our weekly newsletter. So if you want our episodes, resources, and recommendations sent to you, you can sign up at greendreamer.com. And now on to today's episode, where we're speaking with Dr. Christina Lyons.
We're oftentimes focused on like war, on more brute kinds of violence, and there are other many violences, right, that are forms of colonial violences that keep happening and that continue to create these forms, as you mentioned, of alienation or rupture that really rip people away from their home and their lands, right, even if they're still occupying these places.
Christina is an assistant professor of anthropology and with the Penn Program in Environmental Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania. Her current research is situated at the interfaces of socio-ecological conflicts, transitional justice, community-based forms of reconciliation, militarized ecologies, and science and legal studies in Colombia. And her book, Vital Decomposition, weaves together an intimate ethnography of two kinds of practitioners, state soil scientists and small farmers who attempt to cultivate alternatives to commercial coca crops and the military-led growth-oriented development paradigms intended to substitute them. We begin here as Christina shares her relationship to Colombia and what sparked her interest in socio-ecological conflicts and community-based reconciliation.
I started working in Colombia about 17 years ago, and originally I was drawn to the issues around the socio-environmental impacts of Plan Colombia, the U.S.-Colombian war on drugs. And I had the opportunity before I entered into a PhD program in anthropology to work as a voluntary kind of consultant for an international human rights organization in Ecuador, meeting Colombian refugees who were now on the other side of the border and getting to know the cases of people who had been rejected refugee status and the humanitarian status in Ecuador and why that was the case. And many of these individuals that I met were people who had been affected by the U.S.-Colombian war on drugs and had been aerial fumigated with glyphosate. And because of this, they were not eligible for humanitarian status as refugees because it was assumed that they were engaged in illicit economic activity. And given that this aerial fumigation counter-narcotic strategy was a legal policy and was geopolitically backed by the United States and funded by United States foreign policy money. And so my relationship to Colombia was, you know, I had worked and volunteered and studied and worked in different Latin American countries, really around issues of U.S. intervention, militarized intervention, foreign policy interventions, economic interventions in the Americas. and the impacts that this had on human rights, on workers' rights, on environmental justice issues. And so I came to Colombia through my concern and through a solidarity work with several NGOs that were doing policy watch work and human rights work to support people who were affected by the aerial fumigation with glyphosate in this chemical warfare. That was the central strategy for many, many years of the U.S.-Colombia war on drugs. Mm. While I started doing that work in Ecuador, and then I moved up into southern Colombia and to the Department of Putumayo in the Colombian Amazon, and I had the opportunity through my work with these NGOs, visiting farms and visiting rural communities and meeting inter-ethnic, indigenous, campesino or small farmer and Afro-descendant communities in the Amazon to learn of the ways that people were resisting not only the armed conflict in Colombia, that over 50-year armed conflict, but the war on drugs. And we're living in the midst of that kind of destruction and violence and contamination, literal poisoning that was provoked by the strategies of the war on drugs. And the strategies that they were engaged in to do that were really built on transforming their relationships with soils, with Amazonian forest, with plants, with lunar and solar cycles, with all kinds of non-human or what we would call other than human materialities and beings and entities. That was part of a political strategy to not only survive, but also to try to flourish and build alternatives to these kind of repressive strategies that were trying to root them out literally based on stigmatization and criminalization around illicit crop production and the presence of armed actors and also extractive industry. So that's a little bit about the background that really convinced me of the necessity to take these relationships, right, that are not only human-based modes of solidarity and alliance building quite seriously and thinking about how life works together, the shared possibilities of struggle and life and death across human and non-human kind of existence and the way that became really pivotal and that has always been extremely important to rural communities in terms of their ancestral and traditional practices.
Yeah, there's so much in what you just said that I would love to dive into throughout this conversation. But I guess to start, we do have listeners all over the globe, many of whom may not be familiar with Colombia's current state and the struggles that their peoples are facing. So to first preface the rest of our conversation, can you give us an introductory background to the socio-ecological armed conflicts going on and the role of the U.S. government and their interests and the war on drugs within them?
Sure. I'll try to be brief. There's a lot of details that I could provide about the nuances and the complexity of these issues. But so what we have in Colombia is a multi-layered series of conflicts and historically based conflicts, right, that have to do with concentration of land, of property, of a traditional political class that has not wanted to democratize labor rights and agrarian reform that then overlays with the more contemporary bases of armed struggle that have to do with these historical agrarian-based issues, but that were then coupled with narco-trafficking and the arrival of illicit crops and the production of illicit crops and commercialization of illicit crops, mostly coca, but also amapola, poppy, and marijuana in Colombia, that then got entangled with financing the war and the different armed actors. So there are a series of armed actors in the historical armed conflict in Colombia. We have leftist guerrilla movements, we have right-wing paramilitary organizations and groups, and we also have the public forces, right, of state and military and police and anti-narcotics police. And so as the armed conflict dragged on in Colombia and narco-trafficking became an aspect of financing this conflict for all the actors involved and their territorial struggles to control the cocaine trade and to control populations in different territories, regions of the country, like especially the frontier regions like the Amazon and other peripheral regions of the country. The U.S.-Colombia war on drugs, which begins in the 1970s, right, and it has a focus on Bolivia and Peru, originally where the majority of the cocoa production was happening. At that time, Colombia was a commercializer, was transforming and commercializing the cocaine, but not producing it. And with that focus of the U.S.-Colombia war on drugs beginning in the other Andean countries, eventually all of the production chain moves into Colombia. And by the late 80s and in the 1990s, Colombia consolidates the entire production, commercialization and of cocaine, which is mostly for consumers in Europe and the United States. And so the original counter insurgency strategy of the Colombian state gets entangled with the war on drugs, and especially the U.S. backing of the war on drugs, which again began in the 1970s, but particularly becomes much more clear when Plan Colombia in 2000, which is the primary U.S. foreign policy, war on drugs foreign policy, gets signed between Clinton and Pastrana, the Colombian president at the time. And Plan Colombia turns into a way to combine counterinsurgency with counter-narcotic strategy. And this really comes to the fore after 9/11, with then President Bush and President Uribe in Colombia, where these conflations of the war on drugs and the war on terror become very closely knit. And the U.S. funds for the war on drugs, which were primarily military and police funding. So 80% of the money through Plan Colombia was going to military and police building and the anti-narcotic strategy, which was a combination of aerial fumigation with glyphosate beginning in 1997 in Colombia and manual eradication of illicit crops and manual spraying of glyphosate of illicit crops. And so we have from 1997 until 2015, when that policy was formally banned in Colombia, finally, aerial spraying of entire landscapes. So not only of the supposed illicit crops, but of the entire ecologies, watersheds, people's food sustenance, forests, soils, and their microbial communities, and of course, human bodies. And so the impacts of that, you can imagine, in terms of public health and environmental consequences for the long term, are quite dramatic. And the policy was very inefficient in eliminating illicit crops, really just pushing them around, displacing them around the country, and was an exorbitant amount of money to engage in this chemical warfare. So that's a little bit of the background. In 2016, Colombia, the FARC EP, the largest and longest running guerrilla organization in Colombia, signs a peace agreement with the national government to formally end the armed conflict between these two groups in Colombia. The Colombian conflict, the armed conflict continues with the ELN, the second largest guerrilla organization, continues to be engaged in war with the state. But also what we've seen in this post-peace accord transition, unfortunately, in Colombia, is the perpetuation of violence and conflict and the reconfiguration of narco-trafficking, criminal actors, and demobilized actors in many of the territories that were previously the epicenters of the war.
I really appreciate this succinct overview, and there's so much more that we could cover and unravel. So I hope to be able to dedicate a future episode just on the war on drugs itself, more broadly speaking. But to move forward, there was an animal husbandry technician and a small farmer known as the Amazonian Man, who I know was hugely influential for you in guiding your inquiries. And he noted to you, "The problem in Putumayo is that we do not know where we are standing," end quote. And this is a common saying that shows how they conceptualize the ground and soil and place differently than the more literal and physical understandings of soil that techno-scientific research might define them as. So can you share what exactly he and his people mean when they say we do not know where we are standing as a crisis?
My meeting of Heraldo Vallejo, this animal husbandry and campesino that I met, and the other families and kind of agrarian networks and alternative agricultural networks that I came to meet in and around Putumayo over the last 17 years, really shifted the focus of my, not only my academic research, but my kind of more activist policy oriented work away from denouncing violence simply, which again is a very important work, right, that people are engaged in, but was really pushing me to think about not only what was raining down on people, right, through these crop dusters with the glyphosate and the herbicides, but what was germinating up from the ground. And that was really exactly what you quoted, was that people were, in this being a frontier region of the country where there's been a series of colonizations, and right, where families are arriving here, individuals are arriving here through different violent processes of being expelled or displaced from the interior of the country through the war because of poverty and looking for economic opportunity, because of land concentration, looking for land, or becoming attached to these kind of boom and bust extractive economies that have characterized the Amazon since its colonial period. And people who were not born here, or even if they were born here, are from families that are from elsewhere in the country. We were realizing that they did not know where they were standing, right? That they were trying to relate to an Andean soil or to the soils that inform soil taxonomy and land classification categories that actually are imported from the United States, from the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, right? And not the tropical soils or the Amazonian soils and their diversity, where they actually were located, right? And they were estranged from the cycles of life that produced the soils of the Amazon. And of course, like I said, there's a diversity of soils, but I was really focused on the hojarasca, this litter layer that's 5 to 10 centimeters of arable soil, which is sustains the entire biodiversity of the Amazonian forest, right? And of course, millennially indigenous communities and their agricultural practices here. And so people were realizing that really they didn't understand how to become part of these relationships, of this nutrient cycling, becoming part of what I call in the book, selva practices, right? The forest practices. And that was the problem. The problem wasn't about, you know, the illicit crops, or was a problem about learning how to become to become, not to be from. I don't know if that makes sense. And how to engage in different kinds of agricultural practices and livelihoods that wouldn't be extractive or just about felling the forest, but to become part of those cycles. And that was really the center of my research became about following those practices, following those kinds of life-making proposals versus focusing on just the denouncement of violence and crime.
Right. And the idea of displacement where land-based or indigenous communities are removed, often forcibly, from their homelands and have that place-based relationship severed, we'd often discuss this as a way that unique ecosystems have been deprived of the biocultural and ancestral knowledges needed to best care for them, to maintain that regenerative relationship and circularity. So this seems like definitely part of what is going on here. And I wonder if we might recognize another form of displacement or disorientation where even some people who may still be in proximity to or in their ancestral homelands, maybe the lands have been transformed and so heavily pillaged and extracted, which have pried open that relationship of reciprocity to serve the interests of outside forces amidst these conflicts, so much so that the communities and peoples can no longer recognize them as a home in which they can relate to and belong.
Yes, exactly. And I think that illicit crop production as a type of capitalist extractive practice precisely worked in that way, right? Where that so many people, because of the lack of other economic opportunities and viable markets and even roadways and transportation, became involved in this chain, this illicit commodity chain, right? And became alienated from their own practices and from their ancestral and popular knowledges. And were just producing a monocrop for export, right, to feed into the desire of consumers of illicit drugs in other parts of the world. And I think that in a lot of my work, what I've focused on, right, is not only, or really, that the armed conflict has been the most violent situation for local communities, it's all the other kinds of violences, right, that are epistemic, that are ontological, that are about rendering worlds impossible, that are about negating people's knowledges and practices, and then imposing on them, even through, like I said, scientific taxonomy or through agricultural extension packets or through ideas about what is a market and what is productive agriculture and what are the correct crops and the techniques to grow them, right, are transforming landscapes, ecologies, and people's livelihoods in ways that are rendering them poorer, right, and dependent rather than more autonomous in types of their food autonomy, but in terms of their livelihoods and political autonomy and their cultural autonomy. And I think that's often overlooked, right? Like we're oftentimes focused on like war, on more brute kinds of violence. And there are other many violences, right, that are forms of colonial violences that keep happening and that continue to create these forms, as you mentioned, of alienation or rupture that really rip people away from their home and their lands, right, even if they're still occupying these places.
Yeah, I think it is really important for people to consider the different ways of conceptualizing violence, because oftentimes communities are facing all of these different forms of more abstract to the layperson or more institutionalized forms of violence that are more systemic and chronic and long-term. And so when these communities might act out in physical violence in defense of the other forms of violence and oppression that they've been facing, a lot of times those behaviors are sort of criminalized and people fixate on those sorts of defensive forms of violence to address the other forms of institutionalized violence that they have been facing. So I think it is important for people to take a step back to look at the more contextualized forms of violence that communities are facing today. And I understand your intention not to simplistically pit one form of knowledge against another, but there is a historical context from the 1970s of what you've named a scientific colonization of the Colombian Amazon that I think would be helpful to weave into this conversation. And you had touched on this earlier as well. But what do you mean by a scientific colonization? And specifically, what has been the impact of this way of privileging a set of tools and knowledge that have no relation to the place it's being used to then guide ecological practices and other policies?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So in the particular context of the Colombian Amazon, right, I was looking genealogically at when the state begins to explore, do an inventory of its Amazon basin, right? And as all states, right, we can think historically about when they begin to engage in soil studies, when they look about taxation based on land, right? When the nation becomes in the imaginary, right, as a connected whole, making of the modern nation. And in Colombia, that focus was on the Andes and the Caribbean, not so much on the Amazonian or the Orinoquia of the country until later. So in the 1970s, the Colombian government, with support from Holland, engages in its first inventory studies of the Amazon. And they're doing, mapping, and they're engaged in soil sampling, and they're trying to do an inventory of the biodiversity and understanding the communities that are inhabiting these territories. And the scientists, the soil scientists that I was able to meet and interview, who are now, elderly men, because these are all men, really were telling me about, how they were shocked by the fact that they were, from an aerial view, looking at these exuberant Amazonian forests, only to find that these 5 to 10 centimeter, hojarasca layers, literally litter layers that weren't even soil to them, according to their scientific definitions, were what lay below. And it was a great disappointment, because it did not, for them, signal a potential for future economic development in terms of industrialized agriculture or wide, cattle ranching, extensive cattle ranching, or other forms of industrial production. And this is similar to what's happened, in other parts of in Brazil, the Brazilian Amazon, and Peruvian Amazon, and other parts of the world that have Amazonian part, that have pieces of the Amazon basin. And so the first writings about the soils of the Amazon by these scientists were really stigmatizing. I mean, they were explaining that the soils were thin and poor and acidic and senile, right? Literally. And they weren't really sure what to do with them, which of course negates the ancestral practices and knowledge and the civilizations of the Amazon, right? That were successfully living, growing, being part of the selva. And why the stigmatization of the soils and happened. And that's because the soils that they were looking for were based on scientific definitions, right? Like I said, that came from the USDA, soil classification systems from temperate climates, not tropical ones, that were creating categories that were based on the productivity of soils, but the productivity according to a certain standard of what is productive, what kinds of crops, commercial crops, can be grown. And the Amazon, of course, is strength is in its polyculture, not in its monoculture potential, right? In the biodiversity, the amount of medicinal plants, fruit, nuts, tree varieties, all the fauna that supports, the diversity of birds, the water sources here. I mean, right, all these other things that cannot be understood through just commercial agricultural modes of analysis, right, of defining priorities. And so originally, these stigmatized representations of the soils of the Amazon were published and really troubled any kind of economic model, and continued to play or to haunt the ways that development policies for the Amazon were formulated. And eventually, as I write about, so not only these kind of racist representations of poor soils, quote unquote, made poor people, hence indigenous people were impoverished according to these representations, but then later through the war on drugs discourses of the USAID, that the poor soils made criminal livelihoods and more propense for criminality, right? Illegal, illicit activities. And so we see this continuation from a racializing discourse to a criminalizing discourse over, you know, decades. And unfortunately, this has really come to plague the Amazon in the sense that there has not been state support for what we would say would be Amazonian-based development, right? Like understanding the kinds of ecosystem services, ecotourism, scientific tourism, Amazonian agriculture, and all the things that the Amazon provides, right, and the kinds of economies that could flourish here. And unfortunately, there's been only an extractive look, an extractive, on the one hand, extractive boom and bust economies that go back, like I said, to the colonial period. And now we see this in the form of oil drilling and industrial mining projects that are encroaching on the Amazon and proliferating, or on the other hand, as a war zone, right, where illicit crops and illegal armed groups and then the supposed communities that were supporting them needed to be eliminated, needed to be eradicated, and need to be domesticated. And I think, unfortunately, in Colombia, I mean, I'm talking about the particularities of Colombia, but many of these issues, like I said, traverse the whole Amazon basin, right? And the ways that nations have tried to deal with their Amazons and the peoples of the Amazon.
Mm. I think a lot of this illuminates how critical it is for people who have place-based relationships with their landscapes to be the ones to lead ecological and land care practices and to also define development in their own ways rather than have these few global powers dictate to the world like what that should look like. And a lot of this also brings up very foundational questions like how is soil even defined? How is soil health understood? And then what is being measured to determine the health and fertility of the soil? And I know that various alternative agricultural practitioners that you've encountered who see soil in a more cultural and relational way are working to decolonize their farms. So how have they grappled with these foundational questions and use them to guide their visions in terms of how they want to shift their relationship with their lands and the farmland and soils?
Exactly. Like soil science and soil scientists themselves lament this now, nowadays, right, became very hitched to industrial agriculture at the expense of understanding soils and their relational and their historical and all of their ecological roles and functions and relations. And that means that the sciences of chemistry and physics really dominate soil science because of the interest in precisely in chemical inputs and in the structure of soils for industrial agricultural purposes, and not the biological life of the soil, life in the soil, the microbiological life of the soil and life in the soil that actually makes soil soil, right? Soil is a mix of minerals and air and water and living organisms. And so unfortunately, right, this dominant science is within soil science that kind of invisibilized the importance of understanding the biological and ecological life of soils. And I think that is precisely what the farmers and the alternative agricultural practitioners and networks that I've had the opportunity to accompany and learn from, that's where they're focused on. They're focused on, right, not what's a good soil, what's a bad soil, what is the soil good for, right? It depends, right? It depends on all soils are good soils, right? It depends on what we want, how we want to relate to them. And if we're trying to force them to do things that we want, or if we're trying to understand what relations these soils are part of and what kinds of life-fostering capabilities they have. And I think that especially the farmers here in the Amazon taught me that, you know, doing a chemical test of the soils really was useless because all of these chemical tests would just come back saying the soil was, you know, toxic, was acidic, was bad. And really there was ways that on the farm themselves, they could understand the kinds of how to recover soils that were degraded, right? How to foster more life, how to cultivate in a different way that was following the logics of the selva, of the Amazon, right? Versus trying to tame and trying to domesticate the Amazon, right? Through felling, through burning, through clear cutting, through monocropping. So there was all kinds of different gardening practices, all kinds of different relationships with seed diversity, agrobiodiversity, trying to return to, you know, agricultural practices based on the lunar and solar cycles, et cetera, right? That were for them about not only regaining their autonomy, economic and food autonomy and political autonomy, but freeing soils from extraction, from exploitation, from laboring in ways that were exploiting them. And I think that's really interesting. And that's a political struggle across beings, right? Not just for the human, for humans, but for other life forms that have been trapped in the logics of capitalist and neoliberal and privatizing logics. And I think that was really, for me, such an inspirational, not only conceptual work that they were doing, of course, but material practices and recovery of knowledges and practices.
Yeah. And I think the way that you speak to soil, as you learn from the peoples you've encountered, actually goes beyond the biology of soil too. So to lay the grounds for my next question, I want to read this powerful excerpt from you. You say, soils defy modern dualism between nature and culture and quote-unquote living bios and the quote-unquote non-living matters of geos. As such, they also trouble modern temporal divides between past, present, and future. There's no final material erasure of the past in the sedimented and residual fabrics of their recycling bodies. When a horrible event occurs in a place, many rural communities in Colombia and elsewhere say the soils, plants, trees, and other elements and beings retain this violence, end quote. As we speak, what's been on my mind is this field of regenerative agriculture, which is kind of trending as this quote unquote rediscovered way of tending the farmland that can heal the soil, take into account the biology, help to draw down carbon, to serve as a solution to the climate crisis. And what stands out to me is that the dominant field of regenerative agriculture, even if they attribute the practices that they use to various indigenous cultures, they do take on that more techno-scientific way of seeing the soil, of defining and measuring soil health, which tends to exclude the memory of traumas and violence embedded in those layers of the land, therefore, which also largely excludes the need to heal indigenous communities and relationships as a part of the regeneration. So I'd just be curious to hear if you've had a chance to think about the dominant discourses around what it means to regenerate and improve soil, to reverse ecological breakdown, and anything else that comes to mind for you here.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of potential in conversations and dialogue between these different paradigms and really ontologies, right? When we think about agroecology and permaculture and organic agriculture and restorative agriculture and these other processes or movements or paradigms that you mentioned, right? So it's not to say that they're mutually exclusive, but I think that as the farmers here in Putumayo taught me, they're not agroecologists, right? They are Amazonian farmers. The ways that they learn or how they have learned and unlearned practices is based on their relations with this place and with all the beings, the organisms, the entities, the spiritual forces as well that are part of this world, which is different from the science of ecology, although can be in conversation with it, right? And agroecology has different lines of thinking and practice, some more politicized, other more scientific, right? And of course, I've had a chance to converse with different scholars or different practitioners in these fields about these differences. So I think that it's important to look for the potential for dialogue and collaboration and solidarity without erasing the differences that are important, right? That are important to the different histories and the genealogies behind how these practices carry on and continue on and which ones have more power or circulate more than others do, right? And if unfortunately we're invisibilizing or marginalizing different communities in the process. And I think that that's something that's also thinking about globally where these practices are emerging from, ones that are coming out of the global north or in post-industrial landscapes versus practices from practitioners, ancestral, you know, indigenous and popular processes in the global south. And the different histories of colonization, but the different histories of modernization, industrialization in those places. And the ways that it's really important for scientists, but also for local communities, lawyers, and community practitioners, right? Like finding these interdisciplinary and intercultural conversations that can only make scientific practices and non-scientific practices stronger together, right? I think versus pitting them against each other. But I do think that it's very clear to the farmers and to the rural communities that I met, right, that they need to be more suspicious of anything packaged up as science because science was often hitched to neoliberal agendas or industrialization, right, that was always negating the reality of small farmers, the economies of small farmers, the family structures of small farmers, and their ways of relating to place and to soils and, you know, other organisms and beings.
I love the approach of definitely not wanting to exclude, but also recognizing that there are different power dynamics between the different sets or forms of knowledges that are being pushed. And oftentimes, those closest to the land, their life ways, their place-based knowledges tend to be more marginalized in comparison with the top-down solutions that are often imposed onto these communities. And something else that all of these inquiries have led you to is to rethink the relationship between life and death and materiality and politics under everyday conditions. And as you say, how struggles to live well are never separate from creating the conditions for dying well. So what wisdoms have you personally gained from looking at all facets of decomposition and recomposition in this more holistic way? And what has that meant for you when processing our varied eco-social conflicts?
Yeah, so it was very, as I said, inspirational for me to learn from the hojarasca, right? In this, exactly, the cycling logic, this recycling logic that cannot be ruptured, that there always needs to be processes of dying, of decomposing in order for life to germinate, which is quite different from a kind of stark binary between life and death, right? And thinking very seriously about dignified ways of dying and death versus violent ripping, massacring, genocidally taking of life, right? And the stakes of that, and for whom? And again, these are stakes for not only human lives, but for other lives in the territories. I think that was very important for me to learn, especially in a context of an ongoing war, the armed conflict, but also this war on drugs and chemical warfare components, and thinking about that people's struggles weren't just for what Moore has, you know, been popularly written about, this bien vivir or living well, but about how to regain the capacity or the possibility to die well, to die in a dignified way that would be about dying back into place, recycling back into your homeland, into your territory, versus being ripped from that. And I think for me that there's no separation in those struggles. And the proposal of living well is also about, you know, about dying well, as you mentioned. And I think that's, you know, obviously that became something very central to thinking about how life carries on in the midst of war and structural violence. And so that was, you know, all due to the hojarasca. Like the hojarasca inspired, in both a philosophical but a very concrete political sense, think about this continuum of life and death versus the binaries that are often very dominant in not only scholarship and in theory, but really in the way that policies are devised. And yeah, so I think I can thank the hojarasca really this litter layer for providing the inspiration and teaching those kind of lessons.
Yeah, and thank you so much for passing what you've learned and your inspirations onto us here as well. Before we go into our concluding fire round questions, what else do you feel called to share in this moment? And what are some of your calls to action or deeper inquiry that you'd like to invite our listeners to walk away with?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, just briefly, I mean, for me, in the last few years, especially after the official signing of this peace accord and seeing the perpetuation of violence and thinking about what is peace, how do you construct peace in damaged landscapes? Like, what does justice mean when violence continues? What is the transition to what, right? When we think about transition or restorative justice practices, I think that the only things that really have been hopeful for me are thinking about bettering the manner of living conflicts, of inhabiting conflicts, rather than trying to imagine in this fictitious way we can just eliminate them. Because eliminating conflict also is about depoliticizing, and often it's quite violent when we think we're just going to build consensus and forcibly impose that consensus on diversity, right? Diverse ways of thinking, diverse ways of being. So I think that for me, like bettering conflict, how do we better the way we live our conflicts? There are so many of them, right? And not only are socio-ecological conflicts, but of course political, are strictly human-based conflicts. So I think on the one hand, thinking about bettering conflict, and also really about the potentiality of alliance building and the need for all kinds of alliance building that can be partial that does not eradicate the difference, right? That respects the diversity. And that's often surprising, you know, unexpected alliances, I think are really important now, and especially the way that brings together transdisciplinary practices, but diverse ways of thinking and being and creating space for that. And I think that's crucial for professional, for community organizing, for our political questions, for climate change issues, you know, all around the board. So those are just two things that I'd say, like a call to better conflicts and to, you know, look for more alliance building possibilities and potentiality.
What's an uplifting social media account or publication you follow, or a book that's been really profound for you?
Yeah, so I think the a book that recently has been very profound for me is the novel The Overstory by Richard Powers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's just an amazing journey into the life and liveliness of trees and those humans who are allies in defending the worlds of trees, but as well as those who want to turn them into resources. I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful novel.
What are some personal mottos, mantras, or practices that you engage with to stay grounded?
I think to stay inspired and grounded, I just keep trying to find ways to do public engaged scholarship. That's really the center focus of how I inhabit the university and academia, but, you know, research and how to be a practitioner in the world.
Mm. And finally, what are some of your biggest inspirations right now?
I think right now, what I find inspiring amidst, you know, a lot of despair and mourning that's happening, is the growth in support for transdisciplinary scholarship and practice, which I mentioned several times, right? Between the sciences, whether they're natural and social, the arts, and diverse communities. Another inspiring situation right now for me is the decolonization of Western law that we're seeing in rights of nature sentences, but in intercultural legal frameworks that are emerging in many countries and many places. So I think that's another inspiration. And lastly, I would say the role of youth in recent uprisings and social mobilization around the world and the linking of environmental justice and social and racial justice struggles in these movements, I think, is tremendously inspirational and, you know, is providing important lessons for us all.
Well, we are coming to a close, but Green Dreamer, to learn more and stay updated on Christina's work, you can head to her website, christinalyons.com. And you can also follow her on Twitter at christinalyons17, on Facebook at christinalyons, and on Instagram at christina.lyons.10. Christina, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's been an honor to be in conversation and to learn from you. What final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers?
Well, just to thank you and to thank the Green Dreamers for this invitation. It's been wonderful to have the conversation. And I would say, obviously, that we all need to keep dreaming. We need to be hopeful and to know that justice is not just for the sake of our lives or for human lives, but justice is a shared struggle across all life forms and death, of life and death.
This episode of Green Dreamer was brought to you by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show to continue starting at just $2 or to make a larger tax-deductible donation, you can head to patreon.com/greendreamer. Also, if you get the chance to share your favorite episodes with loved ones or to write us a 5-star review in the podcast app, this all helps us so much and we are so grateful. The song featured in this episode is American Trilogy by First Nations Elvis, provided to us by Indigenous Cloud. Our audio producer is Scott Donnell, our production manager is Tammy Gunn, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Take care, and I will catch you soon in the next episode.